This is the Interfaith America podcast, and I'm Eboo Patel. Welcome to a special episode of the Interfaith America podcast. I'm Eboo Patel. I'm frequently asked, what does an interfaith leader look like? The simplest answer I can give is my friends and colleagues, Janan Mohadra and Rebecca Russo, both vice presidents at Interfaith America. They each embody what it means to be an interfaith leader in their work, in their civic lives, their respective religious communities, and increasingly on the public stage. Just 2 weeks after the Hamas attacks on Israel on October 7th and the subsequent Israeli bombing and invasion of Gaza, Janan, who is Muslim and the mother to three beautiful Palestinian children, and Rebecca, who is Jewish and has multiple personal and familial connections to Israel, and is also the mother of three beautiful children, came together to publish an op-ed insisting on the importance of seeing each other and each other's people as fully human. Since then, they have presented together on numerous campuses and webinars, narrating their personal stories and the friendship that, in the face of ongoing devastating news and pushback from their own communities, they insist on maintaining. I am so honored to turn over the Interfaith America podcast to the two of them today to share their stories and perspectives with you. Janan Mohadra and Rebecca Russo, I'm honored to be your friend and colleague, and I'm so grateful for your willingness to share your stories here on the Interfaith America podcast today.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Russo, and I'm the Vice President of Higher Education Strategy at Interfaith America.
I'm Janan Mohadra, Vice President of External Affairs here at Interfaith America.
So as we both know, and as I'm sure everyone listening knows, our civic spaces in the United States have been rife with conflict based on the war in Israel-Palestine over the past 5 months or so. So whether we're looking at school boards or college and university campuses, people being fired in companies, there is so much intense pain that is present within communities here in America and so many spaces where it feels like our fabric is starting to tear apart because of what's happening in the Middle East.
And I think following that, we both understand that these past 5 months have been visceral for both communities and for many communities, which is built on decades of disagreement and conflict on this particular topic. It's built on decades of violence and competing narratives. And in this moment, it has really led many of us to go inward and to focus on the safety of our own people. We understand this crisis feels and is existential for so many of us.
And I know I have been struggling with, and I think you have too, balancing how do I look inward and support my people during this time? And also, how do I look outward and build relationships as hard as it is across divides?
Today, I think we're going to explore some really important questions. How can we be better at understanding and engaging religious and cultural dimensions of this conflict and build our muscles for empathy? And how can we engage with each other more productively in order to preserve and strengthen our shared life together here?
So let's start with some personal storytelling so we can share about who we are and how we came to this work and where we're coming from around this topic. Would love for you to start and tell me a little bit about your story and background.
Yeah, sure. So, Rebecca, as I've told you many times, I'm sort of the poster child for a third culture kid, right? So my family comes from India. I grew up in Qatar for most of my childhood and teenage years before my family resettled here in the suburbs of Chicago. But coming from a space like Qatar where Muslimness was very much everywhere in public life, and then moving to the United States in the late 90s, where my Muslimness for the first time was part of a minority community, it was a big change. And I wasn't particularly religious at the time and, you know, was kind of trying to figure out what it meant for me to be here and to have that identity. And it was really when I went to my undergraduate education, I went to DePaul University here in Chicago, which is a Catholic university. And I went to DePaul because I was really attracted to the way that DePaul talked about service and all of the service learning stuff that was very vibrant on campus. And it was through that space that I actually found my way into being a much more observant Muslim. I very quickly became very active on campus in the Muslim group on campus. And my junior year of college was the year of the Second Intifada, what many of us call the Second Intifada. It was a year of much conflict and violence in Israel and Palestine. And I was one of those college students who was actively putting together protests and actively putting together learning tables and being on campus and talking about Palestine in very important and loud ways. And at the same time, I was also a work study intern at my college's university ministry office, which was focused on helping many different religious student groups. And I remember this one particular day vibrantly, which is I was at a table in our quad, and there was a table of Jewish students across the quad from us, and there was a lot of yelling and intense conversation. And when my shift at the table came to an end, I had to, you know, tag in my teammate, and then I had to go up to my work study job. And part of my responsibility that day was to talk to the food provider for the campus, and I had to advocate for them to have more access to kosher and halal meals. And I was sitting on a table next to the person who I was just screaming across the quad with to ensure that they had kosher meals and that we had halal meals. And that was part of my job. And I had to do that. That experience to me really sort of speaks to this particular moment in ways that I didn't imagine as a 20-year-old that it would still carry in my 40s, which is how do you sit with this really difficult time, and how do you advocate for the people that you care about and the people that you see as suffering? And at the same time, how do you hold shared space with people that you disagree with deeply? But that's, you know, that's one part of what's brought me here to this moment. What about you, Rebecca? Tell me a little bit about yourself.
First, I just want to say thanks for sharing your story. And that last piece that you shared is something that always resonates with me and I think is really such an example of the work that we are trying to do together, of what it means to hold your own ideological, political, or religious beliefs and to really hold true to those and to fight for them and to advocate for the needs of everyone at the same time. That's just incredibly powerful. So thanks for sharing that. I'm glad to tell you a little bit about my background. So I grew up here in the suburbs of Chicago in a very actively involved Jewish family. My grandparents were deeply involved in the movement to free Soviet Jewry during the 1970s and around that time when Jews were repressed in the Soviet Union. And they were also deeply involved in organizations like Hadassah that worked to build up hospitals and social services and infrastructure in Israel and in Jerusalem to serve all of its residents. And those are just a couple of examples, but I grew up with a very strong sense of connection to Jews around the world and a unique sense of really responsibility and peoplehood for my people around the world. And I didn't encounter much diversity in my life. Sure, there were smatterings here and there, but really when I got to college was my first experience navigating diversity. And there are a couple of foundational moments that I think about as I look back at what drew me to the work that we do now. The first was I was living in Israel for a gap year before I went to college, and I decided to take a course on the psychology of the Arab-Israeli conflict. I honestly have no idea what drove me to take that course, but something about it piqued my interest, and it fundamentally shifted how I thought about Israel-Palestine, but also how I thought about engaging difference more generally, and really opened me up to understanding how narratives are constructed, how we construct this idea of us versus them and the psychology behind that. And it really made me fascinated to learn more about the perspectives that had not been demonized in my upbringing, but had definitely been seen as other, and made me interested in learning more about that and becoming a Middle East studies major, eventually studying abroad in Morocco, returning to Israel for another year after college, and spending more time in Palestinian communities and really trying to understand Palestinian perspectives in a more in-depth way. And the second foundational piece that I think about is I got to college, and one of the first things that I attended was a diversity seminar. And it was an eye-opening experience for me in a lot of ways to consider elements of my own identity that I had not thought much about before. And we talked about race, class, socioeconomic status, gender, sexuality, disability, every facet of diversity that you might imagine, except for religion. And I ended up sitting next to a Muslim woman named Lamia during that session, and we bonded over the fact that we both had this piece of our identity that was incredibly important to us, that wasn't being welcomed into that space, but that we both shared in our own ways. And we started to become friends. And that really sent me into a path of involvement in interfaith and multi-faith work on campus, and finding that I was able to connect with people in this very secular environment who had their own connection to their religious identities and learned a lot from them. And I still think about that experience today as I do my work in higher education, helping people think about how do we invite this element of identity? How do we invite religious identity into campus spaces?
You know, we've spent so much time in relationship with one another and building our friendship, our colleague work relationship. And I often think about, you know, all of the ways in which we have marked other milestones in our life together, right? We both came to Interfaith America as young adults. We both became mothers here. We have navigated lots of different moments nationally in America when as tides have shifted, as things have happened. And I think in some ways, our differences have always been present in our conversations. They have not been invisible. And at the same time, our other shared values and struggles as moms or as colleagues or as young people figuring out how to talk about Israel-Palestine have also been such a big part of that. And I just wanted to say that I have learned so much from you over the years, and it has really been a huge blessing for me, for us to have the kind of space to be able to say hard things and also to be able to share in really small trivial pleasures, like how good the salami is at the Romanian butcher in Chicago, which I highly recommend everybody try out. And I feel like that is a rare thing to have. So I'm just really appreciative of that.
Oh, thanks for saying that. I definitely feel the same way and appreciate both the deep conversations we have and the mundane parts of our friendship. I'll pivot to the last few months because I know that so many people have had their friendships and their colleague relationships really tested over the last few months. And hearing from you in the aftermath of October 7th was such a powerful experience for me as a Jewish person during that time. So I'll share, on October 7th, I was celebrating Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath. I was celebrating the holiday of Shemini Atzeret, which Jews were celebrating on that day. It's not a day when I typically use my phone or communicate with folks, but I happened to be in my bedroom and saw a phone call coming in from my father-in-law. And I knew something was wrong because I've known my father-in-law for 20 years and he's never called me on Shabbat before. So I chose to pick up the phone, and he had told me that there was an attack in Israel. At the time, we didn't know exactly the scope and scale of what happened, but he told me that my brother-in-law and sister-in-law and my two nieces, now there are three. I have a new niece in Israel as of this week. So that's exciting news from our family front. But he told me that they were safe and that as far as we knew, other family in Israel were safe, but they were still getting in touch with people, trying to find out what was happening. And over the course of that day, we went to synagogue, connected with our community, kind of pieced together through various folks information about what was happening. A lot of our friends had family and still have family in Israel and were wondering, are they safe? Is everybody okay? Checking in on folks. And on October 8th, you were the first or one of the first people who was not Jewish who reached out to me. And you said something along the lines of, "This is so awful what's happening. I hope your family's safe. I'm thinking of you." It was a simple message and so powerful. And it was already clear at that time or in the couple of days after that so many of my Jewish friends were feeling lonely at that time, were feeling not seen and supported. They didn't have colleagues who reached out, even if they knew they had family in Israel. Folks were turning very quickly to blame Israel for what happened or even to deny what happened on that day. And I just appreciated that when you reached out to me, it wasn't about politics. It wasn't an analysis of what happened that day, why it happened. It was just, you knew that this was personal for me, that I had family there, that I would be in pain. And you reached out to me as a friend, and that really meant the world to me. And I think really set the stage for us to be able to not only continue, but really deepen our friendship over the last few months and be able to talk about really hard things together.
Yeah, I think back to that day, and I was actually traveling when I texted you, I think, if I remember correctly. I was traveling back from a trip for Interfaith America, and I remember thinking, I need to text my friends, right? And that was one of the first things that I wanted to do. I texted you, and I texted two other people. And then the other thing I thought was, I need to go home and talk to my kids. You know, I'm myself not Palestinian, but my children are part Palestinian. Their father is Palestinian and comes from a family who had to move out of their village in 1948 and had to resettle in other parts of the world. And that's a really important part of our family identity. you know, so I knew, especially for my preteens, like I knew they would have questions and they would be hearing about it in their social studies class. And when they did their newsreels at the end of the period, right? So I had to talk to them. So I remember feeling this weight of both the pain and the sorrow that my Jewish friends were feeling in that particular moment, and also feeling this like horrid anticipation of what was to come after and how to prepare my children for it and how to come into the space of being able to hold both of those things. And I won't say that was easy to do. It's still hard to do, right? I mean, it's still hard to be sitting in that space. And now the devastation is so much larger than I could have ever imagined it could be. But I think that's the secret sauce here, right? It's the possibility of being able to hold the kind of empathy and love for each other and for our own communities in ways that helps us show up to this space. And to understand that, you know, our conversation here is not going to change the situation in Israel and Palestine right now. And at the same time, maybe that conversations like this can help us navigate how we effectively as communities speak for our people and at the same time be able to recognize that there are some things that perhaps we can work together on, even while disagreeing on other things.
Absolutely. There's so much that our communities have in common, and it's easy to lose sight of that. But my oldest child is actually part of an interfaith program right now at his Jewish day school. And they visited a local Catholic school last week with a Muslim school. So there are three schools that are joining together. And it was heartening for me. He has his own perspectives on the topic. He's not quite as interested in interfaith stuff as I am, but he was starting to learn about Ramadan and about Muslim practice. And I just appreciated that he is starting to learn about other communities and be able to identify what are some of those common threads. And this actually came up as we were talking about a Jewish fast day that's happening this week. And he was mentioning that Muslims also fast during Ramadan. So those simple things give me a little bit of hope amidst the challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's pivot a little bit to the broader communities that we're part of and how this particular moment, we're each, you know, wrestling in our own way to be part of those communities and also the dynamics that are happening there right now. What are some of the Jewish values that are really informing and animating the way that you are responding and wrestling with this current moment?
Thanks for asking that. It's something that I have been thinking about a lot in the last few months. And I know something that we have talked about is the importance of recognizing the humanity of everyone involved in Israel-Palestine. And even as we may find ourselves on one side or the other, recognizing that there are thousands of human beings whose lives are being impacted or destroyed by this violence and making sure to hold the humanity. And for me, that comes from my Jewish values. And part of why this has been so hard for me to navigate is that I am holding multiple Jewish values in tension at this time. And as I mentioned before, I have a deep commitment to Jewish peoplehood. I really see the larger Jewish community as my extended family. And I'm also grounded in the idea from the Torah that all people are created in the image of God, and that the idea, you know, that saving a single life is like saving the entire world. And we really value in our tradition the importance of humanity and each and every human being. And there are so many times in the last few months when those values have been in conflict with one another, and it's hard to think about how do we balance them. Part of our Jewish tradition and many of the holidays that we celebrate are around people tried to persecute us, and we were able to survive it. And we need to focus on our own self-preservation. And at the same time, when I'm for myself alone, what am I? I'm not living out my values in the world as a Jew if I'm only focused on myself or the needs of my own community. And this also comes deeply out of our texts and tradition. As we think about the Exodus story from the Jews leaving Egypt and being freed from slavery, we are always taught, do not oppress the stranger because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. That the lesson of we were oppressed is also not just focus on our self-preservation, but don't oppress others and don't oppress the stranger. And I hold these two things in tension and with one another for me as Jewish values. And as I think about both, how do I support Jewish survival and Jewish safety and continuity and my unique responsibility to my own community, I also think about how do I uphold the value of preserving human life and seeing every human being as infinitely valuable. And those values are guiding me right now. And it's hard to figure out how to live those out in the world in such a challenging time.
You know, there's a hadith, which is a saying of the prophet where, you know, someone asked the prophet, what do we do if it's the end of time? Like, what do we do? And the prophet says something, and I'm paraphrasing, even if it is the end of the world and you have a seedling in your hand, you still plant it. So even when there is apocalypse around you, you still plant the seedling because you don't know, you know, what that little inkling of hope could do. You don't know what that little good deed could actually manifest into, even in the last hours of our time together, right? And to me, in some ways, that's kind of how this feels. It feels like it is a time of so much crisis that every little seedling of hope, every little seedling of cooperation, every little seedling that leads to something better can maybe lead to something better. And how do we not? We can't divest ourselves from that. We can't, you know, retreat from that. And there's a verse in the Quran that I have often gone back to in a time of crisis, which says something like, you know, be witnesses for justice and for good, even if it is against yourselves and your family and your people and your community, right? And I have used that often in times when I am looking at my own Muslim community, specifically my American Muslim community, critically in a time of crisis and asking myself the question of, you know, am I being a witness for good? Am I being a witness for justice? And am I willing to be a witness, you know, against my community if needed? And I feel like I'm asking that question now in this particular moment, specifically seeing the devastation in Gaza and also in parts of the West Bank. Like, I'm actually asking that question, not just of myself and my community as Muslims, but I'm actually asking that question of our broader American community as well. And that is a moment that has been a moment of pause for me. You know, what does that mean for us right now to sit in this responsibility? And are we doing everything we can in this moment of responsibility while also pushing back on anti-Semitism, pushing back on anti-Muslim bigotry? And is it possible to do all of those things at the same time? And it's hard, and I don't have answers, but I have seedlings. And that's like where I'm sitting right now. I just have seedlings that I will plant everywhere in hopes that something will bear fruit.
I love that framing of planting seedlings. And it resonates with me a lot, too, in thinking about what can we do and what can't we do. Of course, we can advocate for American foreign policy that we think is most important. We also need to prioritize our life together here. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot is just intellectual humility. It astounds me how many people have become Middle East foreign policy experts in the last 5 months.
Everyone.
I feel so certain that they know that what they think is just and what they think is right and what they think will lead to peace,
yeah,
or what they think will lead to justice. And certainly we're all entitled to our opinions and we can all advocate as we want to. But I was a Middle East studies major. I've spent time studying this conflict. And for me right now, it's hard to think about what I think is a just and rightful solution, how we get from where we are now to peace and to living together. But where I can plant seedlings is here and in communities here, and thinking about how do we make sure that this doesn't tear us apart as it's threatening to right now, even whether we are approaching what happens in the Middle East with certitude or with lack of clarity and intellectual humility. How do we plant our seedlings here where we know that we have to share space together?
Yeah, absolutely.
Keep it right here. More to come after the break.
By the way, if you're enjoying this conversation, you ought to check out my new book, We Need to Build: Field Notes for Diverse Democracy. It's a guide for those who want to make positive social change and an invitation into the next chapter of American religion, a chapter I'm calling Interfaith America. We Need to Build is published by Beacon Press and available wherever you buy books. Now, back to the podcast.
So I think this is a great segue into questions that we want to ask each other that maybe other folks are also wondering and that are maybe for some folks like normal questions and for some folks spicy questions. So we'll go into those. So Rebecca, as you know, in a lot of pro-Palestinian communities, there is a lot of effort to distinguish between Jews and Zionists. What do you think about that differentiation? How does that sound to you? And can you give us a little bit of insight on that?
I think this is such an important question because the word Zionist has been demonized. It's been used in many circles as really a slur word, which is really different than how people who identify as Zionists identify themselves. I think actually being able to unpack and define terminology and explore how we understand terminology differently is so important to trying to bridge some of the gaps of understanding right now. So I'll unpack a few things about that question. Zionism has been understood today and in Jewish history in lots of different ways. But I think there are a few important things to share. One is that, generally speaking, Zionists support the right to Jewish self-determination in the land of Israel. Today, mostly that takes the form of supporting Israel as a Jewish nation state. There were earlier Zionists who had different ideas of what self-determination looked like that wasn't in the form of a nation state. But generally, Zionists support the existence of Israel as a Jewish state. And there is a wide range of political views among Zionists. So there are Zionists that support the current war and the way in which it is being waged. There are Zionists who don't support the current war. There are Zionists who support the occupation, and there are Zionists who fight actively against the occupation. So within the realm of Zionism, there's just a huge range of views, including many Zionists who also see fighting for Palestinian rights and justice and liberation as a part of their Zionism, which I think is often not part of the conversation about Zionism. The last thing I want to say about this is that most American Jews see Zionism as part of their Judaism. So when we try to distinguish between Jews and Zionists, I understand in theory why people might want to try to make that distinction. But in practice, the vast majority of American Jews and Jews worldwide are Zionists. So there isn't really as much of a distinction in practice as folks might think that there would be in theory. And what that ends up doing is alienating or speaking badly of the vast majority of Jews. And for many Jews, and probably most Jews, Zionism is also grounded in a deeply held religious belief. So regardless of what you think about the current politics of Israel and Palestine, it is a fact that for thousands of years, Jews have been praying every day to return to Jerusalem, which is our ancestral birthplace as a people, have been yearning to return there, praying for a return to Jerusalem. If you look at the Jewish prayer canon, so many of our prayers focus on returning to Jerusalem, returning to Israel. So regardless of where you hold in terms of your current politics, understanding that Zionism comes from a longstanding return desire for people to return to their home is really important in understanding the term in its current context.
So, Rebecca, let me ask you a question. Can someone identify as a Zionist and still care about Palestinian rights or establishing a Palestinian state? Add whatever else you might want to add in that line of thinking. Is that possible to do?
I think so. I'm sure there would be people who would argue otherwise, but absolutely. There are lots of people who identify as Zionists and who believe that the best path towards a strong and safe Israel is also a strong and safe Palestinian state and community alongside Israel. So that isn't the opinion we often hear in the popular discourse these days, but there are many Zionists who believe strongly that Palestinians have equal rights to justice and self-determination, just as Jews do.
Thank you for that.
So I have a question for you, Janan. There are many issues that impact Muslims around the world, some positively, some negatively, certainly, unfortunately, many examples of places where Muslims are persecuted. Why do so many Muslims in the United States seem to care about and advocate for the Palestinian cause more than other issues that are affecting Muslims worldwide?
So I think there's a few different ways to answer that question. On the one hand, I think there's a question of, is Palestine a specifically religious issue for Muslims? And is that the only way that we see it? Or is Palestine an issue about land and liberty and establishing a Palestinian state? And that is a secular Palestinian state. And that is the only way that we see it. And I actually think the answer lies somewhere in between. I will say that for a lot of Muslims, Palestine and Jerusalem in particular are really important. It is a space that is religiously very important to Muslims. You know, before the establishment of Mecca as the direction that we faced for prayer, you know, Muslims faced Jerusalem, and that is the direction that we faced for prayer in the early prophetic community. You know, it is a space that has a lot of significance religiously. The Aqsa Mosque, which is in Jerusalem, has a lot of religious significance for Muslims. And I will say that, you know, it is not only a religious issue, right? Palestinians are both Muslim and Christian, and probably folks who don't believe in any religion or are secular or atheist or humanist. It is also an issue of establishing an independent secular state of Palestine that caters to all of its citizens, Muslim or otherwise. And it's a really important political issue about land and borders and what that means for nationhood and nation states. In terms of how a lot of Muslim communities feel solidarity with Palestinians, and it's a really important cause, I will say that, you know, I have seen that in lots of different spaces, not just here in the United States, but also globally, that solidarity exists. And a lot of Muslim communities feel that solidarity towards other conflicts as well. I think maybe sometimes I don't see that outside of the echo chambers of my Muslim communities, right? Like when I'm looking at the many WhatsApp groups that I'm on that are talking about issues important to American Muslim spaces, I will regularly see, you know, folks working together on what it means to give importance to refugees coming from Afghanistan or refugees coming from Uyghur communities in China or refugees coming from Sudan because of what's happening in Sudan. Like we hear and see all of those issues in the echo chambers. I don't see them translate outside of those echo chambers necessarily. And I don't have an answer to why that's the case, but that is just an interesting thing to notice. I also think that, you know, a lot of times there is solidarity between people who are trying to establish liberty for themselves. I would say it's somewhere in between. It's not just a religious issue and it's not just a land issue. It's kind of in between for a lot of people. And it's important to realize that nuance and to not frame it just as one or the other.
I appreciate the nuance on that. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to think about less than a century ago, Jews were also fighting for their own liberation and finding their own state. And so it's just interesting to think about the reality we're in now and also the historical context. And how do we try to understand the reality now for what it is, but also understand the complex history that got us where we are?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really interesting in that space is how the narratives that we have in our communities sometimes can just live in their own echo chambers and how those narratives are never put in tension with narratives from the other side, quote unquote, right? So I think we were talking a lot about this a few weeks ago when we were kind of comparing our social media feeds on Facebook or our social media feeds on Instagram or, you know, our like what I would call like dark social media feeds on like WhatsApp groups or text threads or things like that. And how we were kind of seeing that stories that were on my feed, which was mostly American Muslim, were so different from the things that you were seeing on your social media. So I think if I remember correctly, one example was, you know, in early November, there was a Muslim student at Stanford University who had been, I think, struck by a car and someone had yelled like a anti-Muslim sentence at them as they drove off. And my whole community on Facebook, on text threads, everywhere was like talking about this incident. And I remember I kind of mentioned that to you. And then you were telling me about a story that was on your social media that I had not even heard of until that day, which was about a protester in LA. Do you want to share a little bit about that story?
Sure. Yeah. Just around the same time on November 6th, a Jewish protester died during what turned into a violent incident in a protest in Southern California. And that was all over my social media feeds. The echo chambers around this are so real. And it's hard to even think about how do we move beyond our polarized views on this when we're not even accessing the same information. We're all listening to stories and examples that reinforce our worldview, and we can find those stories. But if we're not seeking out what else is happening outside of those echo chambers, it's hard to think about how we can move forward in constructive ways.
Yeah, that is something that's really, I literally do not know how to solve for that, because so much of that is like social media algorithms, right? So if you click on a particular story, then that's what animates the kinds of stories that you get and that you see. So if you're not looking for the story about the quote unquote other, right? If you're not looking, if I as a Muslim, I'm not looking for stories about Jews in America right now, I would not see any of those stories. And if someone wasn't looking for stories about Muslims or Muslim communities, and even in that, I think there is a nuance of like, what kind of story are you looking for? and you'll just get reinforced. Like your bias just gets reinforced in some ways, which is kind of a tragedy if I think about it. Because I feel like in some ways I would hope that when you go into the world, whether that's online or elsewhere, you would come face to face with something that may be in tension with you, or you come face to face with something that may feel different than the way that you see the world. And to not have that be a possibility, or to not have that be something that occurs naturally, is, I don't know how to solve for that. Like, I actually don't know how to come out of that echo chamber in some ways. And in this moment, it feels like it's actually very risky to ask someone to step out of their echo chambers in terms of how each community feels. Safety is with their own people. Safety is to stay in the echo chamber and not necessarily leave it.
Absolutely. And there, you know, I don't want to minimize that there are real fears of safety at stake, both here in the United States. The violence that we have seen against our communities in the last few months is really scary. And of course, for those who have family in Israel or Gaza or the West Bank, you know, there are very real fears of safety. This isn't just emotional safety, but people are really afraid for their lives, their families' lives. And I understand why people are wanting to draw inward and hear those reinforcing messages. But especially as more people are getting their messages and their news from social media and not from mainstream media, even if some of those mainstream media sites are biased, you could argue one way or the other, you get at least some sense of a broader picture of what's happening. But on social media, we don't even have access to that.
Yeah.
I want to share just as one example of how this has played out in a recent report that I read from the University of Chicago that explores college students' fear and beliefs in the wake of the October 7th Hamas attack and Israel's ongoing assault on the Gaza Strip. And they highlighted one example of how language is just used and understood differently. So they asked about perceptions of the very controversial protest chant, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." And they asked if people perceive the chant as referring to the expulsion and genocide of Jewish Israelis. They found that when they asked the question of Jewish students, the vast majority of them, about two-thirds, 66%, perceived the chant that way. And 62% reported being afraid. But when they asked Muslim students how they understood that phrase, only 14% of them thought that it referred to the removal or genocide of Israeli Jews. So we have a situation where people are using a protest chant that they understand one way. Other people are hearing that chant and understanding it totally different, understanding it as a direct threat to their safety or their family's safety. And you can understand why we're having so many challenges when we can't even understand or agree on language use and our definitions because we're so strongly in those echo chambers.
And I think the lack of trust that has now become a very public reality, right? So the lack of trust is basically that there is no universe in which someone can hear that phrase. And in the Jewish communities, and I'm, you know, speaking for you, so correct me if I'm wrong, in a lot of Jewish spaces, it is taken only as a threat. This is a direct threat to the safety and lives of Jews. On the flip side, in Muslim communities, when someone is challenged with that threat, so when someone asks a question of like, isn't this like a threatening statement to make? The vast majority of people that I'm in community with are like, no, of course it's not. It's only about gaining rights and liberation for Palestine. That is what that phrase is about. It does not indicate any harm to Jewish communities, right? I don't think either side can really see how the other side sees that as something that is not threatening and is actually about something entirely different.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I find it so valuable, as hard as it is, to be in community and in real conversation with people that I disagree with on these issues. If someone who's chanting that protest and someone who feels triggered by it could be in conversation with one another, they might identify that there are still areas of deep disagreement, but not disagreement that is about threatening the lives and physical safety of the other. That it's actually something different. But until we are able to have that conversation, we can't really unpack what is language difference and what are areas of real disagreement, let alone how we can move forward.
So thinking about safety and disagreement and the kinds of challenges that we're seeing right now, I wanted to kind of bring forth a story just from a few days ago. So the downtown Islamic Center here in Chicago was recently vandalized. A man came into the building while Muslims were coming in for their nightly prayers that happen in Ramadan and started to scream anti-Muslim things to the folks who were walking in, including, you know, all Muslims should die. And then when he was asked to leave the building, he went and got some kind of object. It's unclear in the video what kind of object it is, and throws it at the center's door, which then, you know, obviously the door shatters. Similarly, just a few weeks before that, the North and Northwest neighborhoods in Chicago received various incidents of anti-Semitic flyers. So more than one time, I think it was something like 3 or 4 incidents were reported of the cars in neighborhood streets being, you know, flyered with anti-Semitic flyers, and that becoming yet another way that we see anti-Semitism play out regularly in the city, right? To have posters or flyers kind of placed on buildings or on doors. And it's almost as if this has become like the status quo right now. I saw some preliminary data recently from the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University that states that hate crimes in 2023 increased nearly 13% from 2022. Driven in part by the increase of hate crimes towards Jews and Muslims specifically. I wanted to kind of both recognize and mark that we are sitting in a moment where Jewish and Muslim communities are under increasing threat in a year where we are going into a very polarized election cycle, and kind of recognizing that and marking that and appreciating the people who do the work of pushing back on those things. I think that our work of cooperation also pushes back in some ways on both anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim sentiments. And I would love to think and talk a little bit about what are we seeing that is giving us hope in this particular moment.
Absolutely. I think it's so important that we find those pieces of hope and things to hold on to as we're in this challenging time. And of course, not to minimize all of the terrible things that you just shared and the reality of that for both of our communities. A couple of things come to mind for me. One is there was a campus where an outside group brought out a truck to dox pro-Palestine folks who were activists on campus and to share their public information and to humiliate them publicly. And there was a group of pro-Israel students that came to block the doxing truck and to say, we don't agree with their politics, but they shouldn't be shamed. They shouldn't be humiliated on campus. Examples like that inspire me and remind me a little bit of the story you shared earlier about advocating for Palestine and also advocating for kosher food at the same time. And there are examples of people showing up to say, we can disagree on politics, but you still deserve dignity as a human being. You shouldn't be shamed and humiliated and publicly doxed for what you're doing. I would love to see more of that. Like, where are there opportunities that we can name the disagreement, affirm the disagreement, but still stand up for each other? I would love to see more Jewish college students standing up against Islamophobia on campus and Muslim college students standing up against anti-Semitism on campus and not seeing that as incongruent with their politics. But it's happening in small places and would love to see more of that. Another example that I want to share is from Cornell University, where they've actually started a new Jewish Muslim group over the last few months. And a group of folks came together in the fall last year from the Office of Spirituality and Meaning Making, the campus rabbi, the Muslim chaplain, and a group of interested students who said, we've had our healing spaces, our separate healing spaces for Jewish and Muslim students over the last couple of months. And we really want to find ways to come together and be in relationship with one another. And they planned a Jewish Muslim dinner last fall that they expected would be a small number of students. 80 students showed up in December to that Muslim Jewish dinner. And they put away their phones and they had table prompts where they shared moments on campus where they were acutely aware of their religious identities. And they shared about their experiences of the last couple months. They started to build really beautiful relationships and friendships. And that is now an ongoing series. And I want to share that not to say that it isn't hard to build new relationships in this moment, but it's possible. And they really started from scratch at Cornell with the efforts of some people that were dedicated to building bridges. And they've started to build a really beautiful community.
Thank you for that. I think another example that comes to mind for me is a more communal example that actually starts with a horrific murder of the 6-year-old Palestinian American boy, Wadia Al-Fayoum, here in the suburbs of Chicago in the aftermath of the October 7th attacks and the beginning of the war in Gaza. Attending this little boy's funeral was one of the hardest things I have done as a mother, but also as somebody who has spent the last, you know, almost 2 decades to the work of cooperation. It felt like such a defeat to be at the murder of this 6-year-old child in a time when so much devastation was happening, both in Israel and Palestine, but at the same time, thinking about what was to come here in the United States. And one ray of solace in that moment, and one ray of kind of hope in that moment, was to see the various Chicago rabbis who attended the funeral of this boy at this predominantly Palestinian mosque in the suburbs of Chicago. And I'll say without any hesitation that those rabbis did not agree with the politics of that community. They did not hold shared values when it came to Israel-Palestine or their opinions on Israel-Palestine. But they came to that funeral in order to show their humanity and in order to show and to sit with the sorrow of this family who had just lost a child. That was really meaningful to me. And it was really important to me to see that in that particular moment, because it was, and it continues to be so dark. And it's moments like that that bring, you know, some light to this situation, to say that we can, there are ways that we can come together in really difficult times, even if it means we sit in discomfort in order to do that, in order to take that step. There's a new campaign that Interfaith America has just launched in partnership with the Ad Council called Shared Tables. And there's a wonderful line in this ad that says, stronger communities are just outside of your comfort zones. So what does it mean for us? What does it look like for us as American Jews and American Muslims and American Palestinians and American Israelis and, you know, all the different ways that we would identify each other's communities? What does it mean for us to step outside of our comfort zones and to think of how to build a community together while also, you know, staying true to our commitments when it comes to Israelis and Palestinians? For me, it's really important to go back to this paragraph that we wrote in the op-ed that we wrote together now 5 months ago, which feels like forever.
Wow.
That said, you know, if you believe Palestinians have suffered under decades of occupation and must fight for justice, you can still express devastation and heartbreak for the killing of over 1,000 Jews. And if you believe Israel has suffered for decades under existential threat from terrorism in neighboring countries and must defend itself, you can still express devastation and heartbreak for the continued killing of Palestinians. This does not require belief in moral equivalence, only compassion and honoring of human life. If the only way to make a case for our people, whoever they are, is to dehumanize another community of people so far that we no longer see them as people, then we risk losing our own humanity too.
Those words from October still really hold true for me too. And I hope that in this moment, we will take time to learn and hear the stories of those impacted, even if they challenge our narratives. I hope that members of all communities will lead with care and create space to honor the distinctive pain of both Israelis and Palestinians, and that we will all ensure that people who are personally impacted by the current violence, whether those in the Middle East or those here at home, have the support and the structures that they need to thrive.
I hope that American communities are physically safe, both Muslim and Jews, and are highlighting our shared humanity and mourning with all of those who are still grieving. I hope that Jews, Muslims, and all Americans who disagree on this crisis will still be able to learn and live together in community so our institutions can function, our public life can flourish, and we can do what we do best. There's a quote by Gwendolyn Brooks that I often go to in moments like this, and she says, "True, there is silver under the veils of darkness, but few care to dig in the night for the possible treasure of stars." Doing this work of deep disagreement and figuring out where cooperation can happen, where it does happen, for me in a lot of ways, is about digging in the night for the possible treasure of stars.
Thank you so much for doing this work together.
Thank you.
And we hope to hear from you. Let us know if the conversation resonated with you and if you would like more conversations like this from unlikely pairs navigating hard moments. Message us in the comments or wherever you live on social media. You can find us on Twitter at Interfaith USA, and Instagram at Interfaith America. To read more about this conversation and to find resources and stories about bridge building in our religiously diverse nation, visit our website, interfaithamerica.org.